Today, on Speaking Out of Place, we are joined by eminent political theorists Michael Hart and Sandra Mazzadra to talk about their thesis of a global war regime and its relationship with capitalist governance, a significant challenge to dominant conceptualizations of war and its relationship with the international order. We discuss colonial continuities, historical transformations, and global Palestine movements against the Gaza genocide as an inspiration for non-nationalist internationalist resistance futures. Here's our conversation. So could you both begin by summarizing for us the argument of the new global war regime? So often, Gaza and Ukraine in particular have been framed as aberrations or violations of the dominant legal order and its rules for the conduct of war. War itself is depicted as a breach or an aberration of the dominant order, and Gaza and Ukraine are then depicted as breaches of the breach or aberrations of the aberration. So what does it mean to speak about Gaza and Ukraine as exemplars or signifiers or even frontiers of a global war regime?
I like the way you pose it because you anticipate or pose the hypothesis that we're trying to work with, which is that these wars in particular in Gaza and Ukraine, the other wars today are not in fact a breach. They're not in fact a departure from the forms of governance, but are rather elements within a new governing structure. And that's what we're trying, with this as an hypothesis, trying to work through. So on the one hand, you could say, as your breach questions pose it, that this has become the norm rather than the exception, these questions of warfare. The other way of introducing it is to thinking about the relationship between war and politics. And that in some, with the way I say it, with a governance regime too, that in many ways, the state of war has become a mode of politics rather than a separation from it. Now, there have long been discussions of this sort of blurring between war and politics, but I think it's taking some innovative factors. It's taking some innovative forms today, but in some ways it is a continuity with some of the analyses from the last 50 years about that overlapping, increasing overlap between war and politics.
Thank you, Michael. And we'll delve more deeper into what is truly innovative and what is a continuity, including from often erased histories of colonial violence and the quote-unquote war on terror. But Sandro, first, your concept of the global war regime.
Yes, I think that the notion of breach is misleading because it's a working international system, while what makes current war particularly threatening, in a way, precisely the fact that they face a fractured international system and even a fractured war system. So the idea of a global war regime is an attempt to grasp the mutations of war in such a conjuncture. This may sound kind of abstract. We never forget the reality, the materiality. We are convinced that there is need to make sense of kind of the specificity of the current wars. And from this point of view, our tentative hypothesis of a global war regime is kind of contribution that we want to discuss.
As we get deeper into the specificities, perhaps we could begin with the central term in the discussion, war, and what precisely you mean by it. On the one hand, we have in dominant usage a very expansive metaphorization of the idea of war. We talk about war on climate change, war on COVID, in ways that allow people to say we are all now victims of war, equivocating across and erasing the differences between the very different ways that people are positioned with respect to the global war regime. On the other hand, we have a very, in some ways, limited and distortive concept of war, at least in a strict legal sense, which really obscures the dynamics of what's happening in a place like Gaza, projecting a false symmetry onto a deeply asymmetrical situation. War in international law is understood as a situation in which combatants on both sides may legally kill and be killed in return. If that's not the case in Gaza or in other theaters of the quote-unquote war on terror. And we also have the projection of a very temporally limited concept of war, which represents it as starting on October 7th, for example, which erases prior Israeli military incursions in Gaza, as well as things like the blockade, which is considered an act of war under international law, suffocating blockade, and yet is constantly erased from representations of October 7th as the start of violence. Michael, when you were on the show previously to talk about your book, The Subversive 70s, you argued that we really lack a language to talk about liberation because so many of the words we would use have been corrupted. But do we also even perhaps lack adequate language to talk about violence and to accurately describe the types of violence that we face through the lens of distorting concepts like war as they've been dominantly interpreted?
I think that's absolutely right. And that's a good point about the concept of war. One of the exercises that Sandro and I tried thinking about the global war regime were a number of other attempts to grasp what has happened to war, that each of them, which seemed to us to have some valuable contributions, but to be insufficient. And one of the things, those concepts that I think you're raising, or at least raising its logic, as you talk about these transformations of war, and especially the international sense of war and international law, is the notion of a global civil war. In some ways, the transformation of warfare against the background of international law does make civil war seem like a more adequate concept, because we don't have, in most of these forum, and certainly in Gaza, we don't have two sovereign entities that are in combat with each other. We have, like you said, asymmetrical conflict within a single space, essentially, is what we have. And that's why I can understand why some would pose civil war as a more adequate concept here, rather than traditional conceptions of sovereign states facing each other. I think that's a good first attempt. We don't even have to go into the inadequacies of them, but I think...
Don't we have to go into the inadequacies
of them? Okay, I guess we do have to go to the inadequacies of them. I think one inadequacy of thinking about this in terms of civil war is civil war assumes that there is a common space, that there, the way we traditionally think of civil war is within even a sovereign space, where there is some contestation of that. But what we don't have in the global system is either a functioning overall entity, as if there were some sort of global state. But then even in Gaza and Palestine, we don't have, it's not as if there's one sovereign space in which there are contending powers. So I think that's one way in which I think civil war gives a mistaken impression of a functioning overarching system. Maybe that's what I put it, which is in some ways in line with what Sandra was saying before. If we had, this is where I was hesitating before, at the beginning of the US invasion of Iraq in 2000, Tony Negri and I had tried to think through the notion of a global civil war, of what was going on then. And there we were thinking about an emerging global system in which these different conflicts were taking part. And I think that today that's no longer an adequate hypothesis, whether it was in 2003 or not, but we were trying then to see what was different about these wars. But anyway, that's the first thing I would say about the inadequacy of thinking about global civil war. It gives the advantages, it gives a recognition of the asymmetry, as you were saying, and the unconventional nature of the kinds of conflict. But it does, yeah, like I say, it overvalues what the global system could be, or some overarching system, which is in fact in crisis. And that's what maybe one of the primary characteristics we have to theorize.
Yeah. So there's a model of a civil war, which is then the framework for a global civil war. But are there other historical precedents we might look to that are perhaps closer resemblances or resonances with the current situation? I'm thinking, for example, with Iraq, when the US coalition was arguing for the legitimacy of their quote-unquote transformative occupation, which breached dominant norms regarding occupation, in which the occupation government is supposed to simply be a caretaker, when they were arguing for the validity of their transformative occupation, they ended up in re-invoking colonial precedents that have now been, like Debra Lashow, which have now been erased from normative international law, but whose logic continues to be perpetuated. Similarly, when Israel argues that its occupation of Palestinian lands is legitimate but doesn't fall under the laws of occupation, they're effectively reviving the logic of terra nullius by saying that it's because Palestinians had no pre-existing sovereignty and therefore the normal rules relating to an occupation don't apply. Similarly, going back even further with the war on terror, historians have argued that many of its modalities resemble not the American Civil War, but the American, quote-unquote, Indian wars predicated on genocide, but the non-recognition of those on the other side of the war as legitimate combatants, again, because of the erasure of their sovereignty. Sandro, maybe picking up on what some of Michael had said, but also to go into this stream, because in some of your previous work, like the Politics of Operations, you point to other colonial precedents for formations of capital that appear novel. Similarly, with these new formations of war, do we also need perhaps to look to other precedents that have been erased from legal and political theory, dominant historiography, in order to grasp the nature of what is happening?
I'm sure this is the case. The legacy of colonial war continues to shape and to haunt the planet. You were mentioning the proliferation of metaphorical uses of war, and I agree with you that we need some on the concept of war. But if you think, for instance, of one of these metaphorical uses, which means the war on drugs in Mexico, it is not that metaphorical. And in the way in which police and the military have dealt with this issue, you can clearly see colonial antecedents coming back. I think something more to be on this, with respect to the traditional notion of law of war in international law that you were mentioning before. Indeed, this traditional notion of war as a kind of armed confrontation between two sovereign armies is not really valid even for the two world wars of the 20th century. With the Great War, the total mobilization of societies and economies, the heavy involvement of civilians already challenged the forms of the traditional understanding of war. And then if you think wars of liberation in the 20th century, again, you are confronted with kind of quote-unquote anomalies from the point of view of the international law definition of the war. So I think we are confronted with a rich archive, and we have to make sense of current wars, often composing an interpretation with bits and pieces taken from this archive. Just think, for instance, of the Ukraine war is completely different, even from a military point of view, from what is happening in Gaza. In Ukraine, you have other images of trench war, and then artificial intelligence, Starlink, digitalized of war. I think this is a good instance of the hybridization of different forms of war in current war.
And in Gaza, you pointed to the contrast between Ukraine and Gaza. How do you see these modes of hybridization or even apparent temporal disjointedness, the combination of very brutal forms of warfare with their high technologization? We've seen very predominantly the use of AI targeting systems in Gaza. How do you see that in Gaza?
Again, you can see a kind of combination between artificial intelligence. The most known example is Levander, in the case of the Israeli army, and then counter-guerrilla in the streets of the cities, and again, images that seem to come from the past, and in this case, clearly from a colonial past. And then the main difference with Ukraine is the fact that in Gaza you don't have enough. You have guerrilla militias and the resistance of the civil population. in this respect, it is quite different from what is happening in Ukraine. Hmm?
It's interesting to me, as we're talking so far, in some ways we have a situation just at a very large abstract level, Thomas Kuhn's scientific revolutions question. We're accumulating all these anomalies for the ways that we typically or have traditionally thought of war, even with different categories of war, colonial war, civil war, the war among sovereign states. And so that's one basis for us thinking that we need a paradigm shift in how we're understanding war because of all these anomalies. But another thing I want to bring up right away, because it would be unfortunate to just leave it to the end, I think much of our motivation in trying to think through this is about the possibilities of resistance and acting against war. It's the old slogan of we need to conduct a war against war has sometimes been ambivalent and it's been often hard to achieve. And I guess I just wanted to orient that our thinking about the nature of war and its relationship to governance today is not really a question about categories or even a purely analytical question. It's a political question driven by what the possibilities of resistance are. And in fact, whether what the forms of resistance readily at hand are really the appropriate ones. So that's really what's driving us. I guess I just wanted to start that early. I think we come back to that, of course, because we need to work through.
But thank you. Thank you for putting that up front and not making it a late add-on or addendum to the analysis, but really the central driving motivation, which informs all of the theoretical and conceptual steps that come before it. So when thinking about possibilities of resistance and conjoining struggles, perhaps something we need to think carefully about is the relationship between what's commonly called war and what's commonly called police. Sandro already mentioned the war on drugs in places like Mexico, technically a police action, but whose warlike character is far from metaphorical. And in fact, we see how analyses, but also configurations of resistance continue to be oriented around presumed spatial separations of different forms of violence. War is assumed to be located mostly outside the borders of the state, whereas prisons and police are depicted as primarily located inside the borders in ways which continue to fracture analyses as well as struggles. And yet these spatial categorizations are profoundly problematic. The idea that war doesn't exist inside the borders erases the nation status of indigenous nations, for example, and settler colonial states who have and continue to be subject to war by their colonizers. And conversely, the idea that prisons and police exist primarily inside the borders obscures the foundational role that prisons, for instance, have always played in contexts of counterinsurgency, colonial counterinsurgency, and which they continue to play today with the production of, for example, mass detention in prison camps in Northeast Syria or the detention and torture camp in Guantanamo Bay, in which those who are detained are treated simultaneously as enemies and criminals and subject to the liabilities of both categories. And so can you perhaps take us through a bit more deeply how this concept of a global war regime challenges predominant spatial thinking about where different forms of violence are located and what it means to analyze them in a global sense that doesn't erase spatial differences and flows of violence, but instead thinks of how they're related to each other. Sandro?
Yes, the concept of global war regimes aims precisely at providing a kind of integrated analysis of different forms of violence. And I think this is a very important point from the perspective of existence, from the perspective of a struggle against the war, against the global war regime. At the same time, I think we are to remain aware of the different degrees of violence, of the different forms that violence. I will just give you an example. Around ago, I started to talk about a war against migrants and refugees in the Mediterranean Sea. It is difficult to say how many migrants have died over the last couple of decades in the attempt to challenge European border regimes in the Mediterranean. Tens of thousands. So from this point of view, I think that speaking of the war makes sense. It helps emphasizing and dramatizing what is happening every day in the Mediterranean. At the same time, I think there is a need to remain aware of the fact that violence is different from the violence we are witnessing these days, these weeks, these months in Gaza. So I think we need a kind of double move. On the one hand, we need to focus on kind of common logic of the global war regime and to provide an integrated analysis of the different forms of manifestation of that regime. On the other hand, we have to remain aware of the differences, of the different degrees, of the different scales of violence.
That's a good point. But I just wanted to focus on the notion of global that we're using in the here in global war regime, because Sandro makes me think this whenever we talk about global, and this has been part of the, I don't know, debates for the last 20 or 30 years, is we have to think the globe or the global space not as homogeneous and uniform, but the primary challenge is to think about the differentiations within a common system. And I think that's what, so that when one says global, one has to come up with, in fact, some sort of an analytical framework for doing that. Like we've tried similar sort of working with that, like thinking about a mixed constitution of the global regime so that we can understand the functioning of supranational institutions together with the dominant nation states, together with capitalist corporations, to think about these functioning together, and therefore not to pose the global as a homogeneous space. Sandro's adding another layer to that. I think when thinking about that, one has to think about the different, like you said, the different modalities and different intensities of violence in different situations, so that when we're talking about war in each of these circumstances, we can recognize that we should be thinking about them together on the one hand, but on the other hand, we have to make these different differentiations of both of kind and of degree. There's just one last thing I wanted to add, which is slightly off topic, but I think everyone recognizes, and this is something from decades ago too. On the one hand, as you were pointing out, as you said, the confounding of war and police action in these efforts, maybe going back to the NATO bombing of the Balkans was a police action too, or even other previous wars were. But I think then also seeing how the militarization of policing, even in the dominant countries, has become a much higher degree. And so I don't mean here to say it's the same thing, obviously, as in others, but the militarization of the police has been remarkable in, even when one just looks at the weapons that they use, from that military weapons, that military, what do you call them, uniform, not uniforms, all the military equipment that the police use, it makes it so you go to some political action, it feels like you're in a war. It looks like war. Anyway, all that's to say, I'm just thinking of these, the way Sandra was trying to put it, is trying to think about a variegated system, but nonetheless, these different levels of degrees having maybe at least a common logic. But I would say it's even more than that, too. It's also, I would say, they're parts of a common governance structure. That's what I'm really mostly aiming at. But that's a little bit further down the road. Yeah.
When we talk even about militarization of police, or conversely, policization of military, that suggests that these are two separate institutions that have had their discrete segregations and logics, and yet their entanglement goes back long before the NATO bombing. In many ways, all colonial counterinsurgencies mixed the logic of war and the logic of police. If we think that the logic of war is that it's horizontal, that you have combatants on both sides that, again, may kill and be killed. This is the premise of war and international law, the idea of the equality of belligerents and combatants' privilege. Whereas the idea of police is based on a more limited capacity to use violence, and yet those on the receiving end lack the prerogative to use legitimate violence in return, the combination of those two things has been a recurring feature through colonial, what doesn't even get called warfare, in order to exclude the colonized from even those limited protections that applied in the conduct of war between European states. And so similarly to how, for example, critiques of concepts of sexuality problematized how the concepts that emerged to describe sexual relations, like homosexuality, heterosexuality, even the concepts of men and women, how those applied very differently in colonized situations, but the production of what's represented as normative depended on the colonial. Do we similarly have to think in a critical way about the very categories of war and police that we use in the first place, whose very production is premised upon an erasure of colonial violence?
Maybe I can provide an example. I'm currently based in Paris, and the French band have long been privileged site of analysis of this intermingling between the and police. Last week, I went to the May Day demonstration, and I was pressed by the fact that even in the center of, you can see the police acting like the military. There has been a kind of shift that is quite apparent in this country. There are new police forces that have been established over the last years. And as Michael was saying, if you look at the guns that they have, if you look at the equipment that they wear, they look like the military. So maybe we are facing a kind of generalization of logics that in the French case have a clear colonial origin, which means the Algeria war and before the management of colonial people.
I have a slightly tangential question that maybe I'm hoping that two of you could help clarify, which is...
Are you reversing the questioner question role?
I'm trying.
You're flipping the script? Okay, that's very subversive of you. Okay.
I have some hesitation. I'm trying to formulate it. Simply resolving to say that what's really different today is what used to happen only in the colonies happens in the metropole, or something like that. That what we're seeing is a generalization of colonial warfare rather than something new. And I think there's probably more to say about it than this, but I just want to start with the idea that I think that the possibilities for liberation that have typically been thought of in the context of colonial struggle have shifted today and don't provide an adequate perspective. I guess I'm thinking specifically of the notion of national liberation as the goal of anti-colonial struggle. And I don't think that's a very helpful mode of conceiving the current wars and actually of our possibilities within these wars. On the one hand, I don't think that national liberation is really on the horizon. But it's more than that. I don't see it as the desirable outcome. And so maybe I'm working in the wrong vein here, because what I just said seems to assume that understanding these as colonial wars would bring with them an understanding of liberation as in terms of national sovereignty. Maybe that's not true. Maybe there are other ways that we should conceive anti-colonial struggle that not as national liberation. But then someone could also contest, and this is where I'm relying on you two, that maybe I'm wrong to say that national liberation is neither plausible nor desirable in the current conflicts. It does seem to me to have consequences, though. That's why I keep trying to work backwards in this process, is to say, what is the process of liberation we can hope for? And in that light, what is our analysis of the mode of domination that we're facing in these wars? How's that to be understood? I didn't quite give you a coherent assignment, but there's something there.
I understand what you're saying. Sandro, do you want to say something first?
The central stakes of the piece Michael and I wrote is focused on the need to rethink into beyond the nation. I think that there is a kind of urgent need to imagine new forms of politics of beyond national liberation. So seems clear to me, in particular with respect to what is happening in Gaza, to the perspectives of the Palestinian struggle for liberation. It is very difficult to imagine an outcome of this struggle that corresponds to the classical outcomes of anti-colonial struggles and even wars. Although what is happening in Gaza right now bears all the signs of an anti-colonial struggle. So this is a kind of paradox that we need to make productive in some way, although it may sound a bit strange in such a situation. But there is a need to activate political imagination in such a deadlock that corresponds to the death of thousands and thousands of people, to the destruction of Gaza and the West Bank too. But against the background of this deadlock, there is a need to invent a new form of politics of liberation. And I must say that also my Palestinian friends and comrades are quite aware of that.
If considering seriously indigenous struggles and the thought that has emerged from them in settler colonial contexts, which have often been divorced from considerations of colonial struggles of national liberation more generally, if this might provide a helpful way for thinking about the question that you pose, Michael, and that also emerges from the paradox that you point out, Sandro. So as indigenous thinkers like Leanne Betasamasake Simpson, for example, point out that solution to indigenous dispossession of lands isn't simply then to reassert indigenous territory or property on the same terms through which the dispossession has occurred. Similarly, there's an assertion that the way to resolve indigenous erasure from sovereignty isn't simply to then claim sovereignty for themselves in those same terms, but rather continuing and drawing on other indigenous ways of thinking about what it means to be politically, legally, and socially organized to develop completely different modes of relationship between humans other than humans and the land. Perhaps this national liberation question is a dead end only if we equate national liberation with sovereignty in the terms through which it's been developed through colonial international law, which we know from the work of thinkers like Tony Enge was predicated on the erasure of indigenous modes of social organization in order to justify their colonization as terra nullius. But we also know from the work of indigenous thinkers like Nick Estes, for example, in Our History is the Future, that there's also a very long history of indigenous internationalisms that haven't been built on the idea of relations between sovereign states, but rather internationalisms that execute themselves in a non-state-centric manner. I don't want to speak for indigenous traditions, but maybe this is somewhere that we could look in order to think about horizons for resistance and just possible futures that don't remain trapped within the confines of colonial sovereignty and nation statism. Michael, did you want to say anything else about that?
No, that seems to me a good thing. I think, so as you were saying, Aziza, too, we're both questioning the object of sovereignty and we're also questioning the national liberation. So and I think that when you're talking about North American indigenous struggles, that seems like one place that one can see important precedents, but there are, of course, many others. But the concept is relatively clear, even if it could sound paradoxical, a non-national internationalism. Maybe one needs a different term for it.
Rather than internationalism?
At least there is a dominant tradition in which internationalism does mean nationalism. And so therefore,
interstatism.
Yeah, but even nation, I think, is a problem here. But you're right, interstatism too. But
maybe the problem is English. Maybe we just don't have the term in English to.
Maybe, but the problem is also that nation has many different meanings. I don't know, if you take India, if you take China, nation has different meaning from the one that it has in France, or you know, I think we have to be aware of these differences, which also regard indigenous movements and thinking, because in many places in the world, indigenous people identify themselves as nations, but they mean something basically different. What is meant, you know, in mainstream European Western political thought, and you were pointing to that.
Perhaps in thinking about spaces of resistance, and we've been speaking about internationalism, we also need to question the role of international law. You alluded earlier to the imbrication and relationship between multiple levels and orders of sovereign power in sustaining and organizing the global war regime. So often when we think of moving beyond the restrictions and violences of the nation state, international law is represented as a haven of liberation to which we can turn in ways that really erase and obscure the role that international law has played in legitimizing and facilitating ongoing colonial and extractive exploitation, as well as legitimizing war through the very permissive license for state violence that is accorded through international, quote unquote, humanitarian law, the laws of war, but in ways that are often much less visible, but at the same time more effective than the restrictions that are placed on state violence through domains such as international human rights law or international criminal law, for example.
I was going to say,
at the same time, we've seen people around the world mobilizing around international law, its institutions, its concepts, around cases like the one brought by South Africa against Israel. But looking to previous examples, we might also anticipate a certain kind of discomfort or paradox that might arise as when critical scholars of international law pointed to the contradictions of their appeals to international law in an attempt to stop the Iraq war in ways that concealed international law's own complicity with the war regime that was unleashed on Iraq. So when thinking about desertion and spaces of is international law a space that we can turn to? Or is it part of the global war regime that needs to be deserted from? Or is it complicated and can it in some sense be both?
I think that national law is not a homogeneous body. It is very articulated and diversified. So international law can be part of the global war regime, but it can also provide weapons to struggle against it. Moreover, I think there is a need to stress what you were just saying, which means the fact that in many parts of the world, national law is invoked against the war, and in particular against Israel war on Gaza. The South African case is quite important in itself, but also for the rest it has in many parts of the world, particularly in what is called in a too generic way the global south. But I could also add to this that China insists on the fact that the main global the UN. So it is repoliticizing the United Nations. And you can also see a kind of genealogy of this. If you think at the conference in Dumbarton Oaks in 1944 and the position of W.B. Du Bois, who wanted to make case there for African-American rights, saying this is a global issue, and not a U.S. national issue. I think that for a long time, the so-called international has spoken with the voice of the West. Of course, there were other voices, but the prevailing voice was the voice of the West. Today is not anymore so. There are many voices that speak international law. This is a very important point.
But does it end up reproducing its same structural constraints, or is it transforming or expanding them? I'm thinking, for instance, with something like the South Africa versus Israel case, or the previous genocide case brought by Gambia against Myanmar with respect to the genocide of the Rohingya. Because of the state-centric nature of the court, the Rohingya in that case didn't even have official standing in the case about their own genocide. Genocide is about erasure, and yet that erasure ends up being reproduced through the very institutions that are now purporting to remedy the harm. But is there actually space, or do you see those kinds of contestations occurring when clearly global South states, and this also points to the limits of national liberation via state sovereignty as a mode of decolonization, that states, Global South and Global North, then also have their own interests in preserving a state-centric international order that may conflict with the demands or imperatives of truly genuine deep decolonization?
The revolution will not happen through international law. I'm sure about that.
But international law may be a useful tactic in the meantime.
That's the point was going to make.
But that seems great, the way both of you are posing this, that they're, but this is the way we treat legal structures within, and even the way one has to treat capitalist domination too, that there's some ways in which capital does provide weapons to fight against it, which doesn't mean that we need to celebrate capital just because, I don't know, some corporation is actually against a bathroom law in North Carolina, or something. It doesn't mean we need to celebrate them. I wanted to turn.
What are some examples that you see of that with respect to the current global war regime?
Of what?
Possible capitalist tools of resistance, but also the limitations of them.
I think maybe this is the point at which we should try to address some of the questions about, or try to work out, even provisionally, what are some of the relationships between global capitalist projects and interests and the current. And the current wars.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about, because often the understanding or analysis of it is limited to like profits by particular military industrial complex companies. Mm-hmm. But with respect to mass incarceration, the prison industrial complex, we know critiques from people like Ruth Wilson Gilmore point to the limitations of understanding the political economy of it simply through the lens of profits for through privatized prisons, but instead thinking more capaciously about the political economy interests that are intertwined in it, and therefore what points of resistance and sabotage might be. So that's exactly what I wanted to ask. So thank you, Michael. Yeah.
And in fact, I would even go back that this is a way the conversation could have started, is to say that these current wars we're confronting aren't explainable simply in terms of putting down a rebellion or something like that. Like, we have to think about what are the interests that these wars are serving. And they're not all uniformly, and I wouldn't, also referring to capital or capitalist interests, I wouldn't say that explains everything. But it does explain some things, or at least there are interesting coincidences. And this, one of them, Sandra and I are particularly interested in, Sandra's particularly knowledgeable about, are about logistical networks and the ways that these wars fit within the interests of both, of some from disrupting logistical infrastructures and some of them about preserving them. But that seems one introduction to these two, like the way that one can think Gaza and Ukraine together. They're obviously very different wars in a variety of ways, but both of them interestingly disrupted established projects of capitalist infrastructure. And that's what And that seems to be one important role of them. I agree with you, Aziza. It's not like we should say, I don't know, with the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, many said, and there's definitely some truth to this, is what Bush was really about was gaining control of the war. It's about blood for oil, that sort of thing. And so I would hesitate both then and today to make this simply a question about capitalist interests. But nonetheless, I think that's it gives us a first separation to be able to think about these wars somewhat differently. Yeah, so the obvious one that we all know about, of course, is about Ukraine, the Ukraine war disrupting the energy and food infrastructures, especially the ones of Russian oil and gas coming to Germany and to Western Europe, but also, of course, Ukrainian food going the other direction, and that the war, in particular, the most spectacular part of this is, of course, the mysterious Nord Stream bombing, that this war interrupted and transformed that relationship, whether in the interests of the U.S. or NATO or something, but it disrupted European infrastructure relationship. What I knew less about before Sandro pointed out to me was the ways that Israel is key in a new infrastructural project of that the U.S., of course, is deeply involved with and depends on the Abraham Accords, which that's the other interesting thing, and that this war is clearly disrupting the possibility of an infrastructural route that comes from India to Europe that is meant to compete with the Chinese Belt and Road infrastructural projects. That seems like an interesting one element to help us think about what some of the stakes in these wars are and how they depend on and are interacting with capitalist interests, the conflicting capitalist interests, of course, in both these cases.
Sandro, did you want to add it? So then, if they're conflicting with capitalist interests, then what are the interests that are being served? And we see this in other contexts as well. For example, as the co-authors of a recent book on the perverse impacts and effects of sanctions on Iran point out, the sanctions have disrupted a proposed project by India to build a port in Iran that would also be a counter to the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative with its port interests in Pakistan. So we see these apparent or conflicts in what the apparent capitalist interest would be. How then is the war in service of a global governance regime?
There's one thing I said, I misspoke or was unclear about, which is, it's not that I think these are in conflict with capital's interests, but they're conflicting capitalist interests. This is much more resonant with another concept, which I think is somewhat helpful, but largely unsatisfying in the end, which is inter-imperialist war. If we were to think of these as inter-imperialist wars, meaning precisely, we have competing capitalist interests with a limited space, and partly the wars are about those negotiating those different capitalist interests.
You pointed to an important question. Marx used to say there are many capitalists in the world. They hold meetings, they have their own politics, but you will never meet Monsieur le Capital, which means Mr. Capital with a capital C. What we see today is that different capital actors are differently positioned with respect to the current war and to the global war regime. It is easy to identify capitalist actors in the sector of weapons production who have a direct interest in the war. But I think it is more interesting and even thought-provoking to look at other capitalist actors that may have mediated interest in the war and in the formation of a global war regime. One of the reasons why the notion of imperialist wars is not fully adequate, I think, is the fact that these capitalist actors do not necessarily have a kind of national denomination. If you look, for instance, at capitalist actors in Germany, you will find many capitalist actors whose interests are strictly intertwined in the, with the Chinese cat. And I think this is something we should always keep in mind. More generally, what is at stake in against the background of the current wars is the reproduction of capital and capitalism as such, the conditions that allow such a reproduction. And this is particularly clear if you look at logistical spaces, at infrastructure. We have noted that the phrase supply chain disruption was kind of prevailing phrase during the pandemic. There is a disarticulation of the spaces within which capital reproduction takes place that started well before Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 22. And
did it start before the pandemic too?
Sorry?
You spoke about the phrase supply chain disruption with the pandemic, but would you date it to before the pandemic as well?
Yes, also before the pandemic, we are living in the long tail of the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008. Different phases, but we never really got rid of that crisis. In the pandemic, it was particularly visible. These images of containers, thousands and thousands of containers stuck in ports in many parts of the world, in the US, in Korea, in China, and so on, was really impressive. I think this is something that provides us with an angle on the relation between capital and war in the current conjuncture. It's not the only angle, of course, but it's an important angle.
As we move to... Oh, Michael, do you want to say something?
To shift. So if you want to use shift first, and I'll...
What was your shift?
I wanted to think about militarization at a broader social level and what the nature and dangers of that are.
Okay, let's talk about that first then, because I was going to close then with the question of resistance.
But let's talk about
the militarization.
Okay.
Because that's, I think, then part of laying out what the field of analysis of violence is that is being resisted. Important part of the global war regime thesis is the idea that society is being militarized in spaces that were previously non-militarized. But I'm wondering to what extent does this idea of non-militarized spaces, again, is it predicated on the erasure of colonial spaces through in which the very production of society or civil society has been built on applications of war power? I'm thinking again of indigenous nations, for example, who are relegated to civil society through the very conduct of war against them. Again, to what extent is this analysis of militarization of society naming something new? To what extent is it a continuation of colonial dynamics? And to what degree do we need to understand the colonial context that preceded it in order to discern what is new or innovative about the current situation?
It's definitely, like many of the other questions we've been talking about, a shift in degree rather than a new invention. But I wouldn't trace it only to colonial contexts. But what's at stake, it seems to me, is a social transformation by which military logics and the kinds of reinforcement of authority that goes along with military logics are having a greater effect on different societies today. So it's just worth recognizing that, it seems to me, to underline the importance of confronting this war regime. So it's not just, I do think it's important, and Sandra and I'm sure both think it's fundamental today that we find a way of opposing and being effective towards ending the, I don't know if we should call it war, massacre in Gaza and the war in Ukraine. But that isn't going to solve all our problems. I guess the problem is larger than that. And so part of it being larger than that is the social transformation that I think goes along with militarization. We have a long tradition of critiques of militarization in social form, going back at least throughout the 20th century, a lot of them during the Vietnam War, and that part of the analysis of the war was the way it was transforming U.S. society, in addition to being the massacre of Vietnamese. So anyway, I guess maybe it's an obvious thing to everybody, but that at war, and increasingly in one way or another, all spaces are entering into being at war, that there goes along with it a social transformation that can go under this rubric of militarization. For me, it only, at least in the part of our discussion here.
What are some of the relevant social, you spoke about increasing subjugation to authority, but are there other transformations, including not only those that are oppressive socially, but also some that are empowering, at least to certain sectors of society?
I'm interested in the empowering ones that you're thinking of. I'm not quite sure. But before that, I was just going to add that there's, I don't know, 50 years at least of, and maybe 100 if you think about different authors, of feminist analysis about the relationships between masculinity or even toxic forms of masculinity and the militarization of society, that there is making opposition of the war a feminist issue is partly about recognizing that coincidence between patriarchy and war and also between militarization authority. So that's one almost easily at hand, it seems to me, recognition or set of analyses about that, about the social transformation. I think part of the reason I wanted to bring it up is I think with the correct framing and focus on the thousands and tens of thousands who are dying, we don't focus as much on these social transformations, which don't have to involve death to involve a militarized transformation. Here, another example of it, but the obvious ones too, is as we were talking about before about transformations of police activities. For instance, in the U.S., even just looking at the university campuses in recent days, seems to be another one can recognize there too a heightened militarization of not only the police force, but then the entire discourse around it.
Militarization of the university as well. This is partially what I was talking about when I meant empowering certain sectors. The patriarchy example is a good one, and anti-patriarchal critiques of militarization and how they've infused and reinforced patriarchal logics in society. With the war on terror too, we see similarly the deputization of certain members of society along racial, colonial, gendered lines to serve as the executors of the war on terror at home through things like see something, say something, so that every airport, every street becomes, in some senses, a theater of the war on terror, although, as Sandra pointed out, at vastly different scales and intensity of violence. And so how does recognizing not only those who are subjugated, but also those elements that are empowered by the war regime and logic of militarization affect our understanding then of what our resistance needs to be? Sandro?
If I look at what is happening in Italy, I can say that within universities, among faculty as well as students, there is a growing way of the militarization of the university. Of the militarization of this. And this is part of a movement of resistance, of a movement of struggle against the war regime. There is something that has become much more visible over the last couple of months. And this, of course, lays the ground also for further development of resistance. And I wanted to add something about the colonial legacy. I spoke of the banlieues in Paris and France, and of the kind of generalization of specific military devices of control that I witnessed at the demonstration of May Day. Of course, we have to be cautious. We cannot jump to say that Paris is in a state of war, because this is not the way in which people living in Paris, proletarian people living in Paris, experience every day. Again, it's a question of degrees, of intensity, and of zones in which the war regime becomes fully deployed also within the borders of specific nation states. But this is something that in a way reminds me of the history of colonialism, meaning that colonialism was homogeneously war and terror and violence. The geography of war, terror and violence that was always present was very diversified, was very graduated in a way. And this is an important aspect in colonial history that in a way comes back today. And how to struggle against this regime that has different degrees of intensity, shifting manifestations, is one of the most important questions that we face today.
On the struggle, which has infused our entire conversation, perhaps this is what we can end on as we wrap up. Sandro, in your book, The Politics of Operations, you write together with Brett Nielsen very beautifully that the weapon of critique must go hand in hand with critique by weapons. What is your hope for the relationship between this theorization of the global war regime that you are putting forward and the struggles on the ground that are occurring against genocide in Gaza, war in Ukraine? But then also, how do you see your theorization dependent on and developing in relationship with the movements that are ongoing on the ground?
First of all, I must credit Karl Marx, the quotation. I don't want to be accused of plagiarism. It's a wonderful quotation. I love it. Secondly, I have to say that I am part of the movements and of the struggles. And I'm impressed by the growing movement of solidarity with Palestine. I think that today, this is the most important evidence to rethink politics against the war regime and also to rethink internationalism. I think there was a shift over the last couple of months, and in many parts of the world, the movement of solidarity with Palestine has started to speak a common language. The idea of global Palestine has begun to circulate. Of course, the protests in the U.S. campuses are very important, but this movement had already started when the police intervened at Columbia 2 weeks ago. To kind of grasp and further develop the virtuality of this global Palestine is for me the most important task in this particular conjunction.
I just wanted to add, is I think that's exactly right and a big challenge, the way that the possibility of transforming solidarity with Palestine in the context of the massacre in Gaza, transforming that into a much larger project. That's what seems to me. It does seem to me a very promising basis. I guess one of the things, the comparison that helps with...
Can I ask you a question?
Please, yeah, please do, yeah.
What you said is transforming Gaza and resistance to the genocide in Gaza as the basis for a larger project, does it depend on the way we analyze what's happening in Gaza in the first place? So often it's represented as a state of exception rather than as... this sort of returns us to where we began to, but as exemplary of a colonial condition. But the fact that Palestinians have been excluded from sovereignty, even in international law, it gets treated as a perpetual anomaly. And emerging from Gaza, do we even also then perhaps have developing a whole new language and framework for understanding the forms of violence that are occurring in places outside of Gaza, but without erasing the specificity of Gaza itself? In other words, to what extent do we need to more deeply understand what's happening in Gaza in order to situate it within this framework that would then enable us to build a larger project?
I like what you just said. The one thing I would maybe add to it is that in addition to understanding specifically what's going on into Gaza to understand this more larger global framework, it might be that we also have to understand this global framework to really understand what's going on in Gaza. So it's not just from the local to the global type thing. I think there's also the reverse action, in which, and one of the promises that this global Palestine holds is giving a kind of foundation in which to think a much larger project of liberation. The example that came to mind for us when we were talking about this the other week was about the anti-Iraq war demonstrations on February 15th in 2003, which were impressively widespread in cities across the globe. Of course, not everywhere, but there were hundreds of thousands. And of course, it didn't stop the U.S. war in Iraq. I think no one thought that it could, but it provided maybe even in that case, just the imagination that we could create a much larger basis for thinking resistance and possibilities for liberation. So sometimes I get mistaken about these things. I assume that we're at a relatively early stage in figuring out what this could be. That doesn't mean that there aren't important and solid possibilities or foundations, but I don't mean to be saying that, I don't know, that the opposition to the massacre in Gaza is the foundation for some new international. I think it's reignited the imagination of an international, or even a project of internationalism, maybe, as in opposition to, and that's where I would just go.
Internationalism that we're not going to call it.
Yes.
Well, unless, for a better term.
For lack so far of a better term. Even Huey Newton's intercommunalism probably doesn't quite capture what we're getting at, but that's another, what would you call it, admirable attempt at getting away from the nation. But it's also true that the tradition of internationalism carries many instances that thought of it as not the relationship among nation states or national projects. The non-national internationalism also has a important legacy. So I wouldn't abandon the term right away because of that past.
Reappropriate it. Is there, go ahead. I was just going to ask if you each wanted to make some final comments to.
Just a follow up on what Mike was saying. I remind very well the war in Lebanon against PLO in 1980. I remember organizing many demonstrations, many solidarity activities. At the time, it was clear to me that we were supporting a movement that was struggling for national liberation. But that movement was far away. Although Lebanon is not so far from Italy, indeed. But it was politically far away.
Imagine the geography rather than physical geography.
Yes, exactly. Today, it's quite different. I participate in many assemblies. I speak with the younger people who are mobilizing, and they identify themselves with the condition of Palestinians. Of course, it is complicated, because they do not risk, we do not risk to die under the shelling. But I think this is a very interesting moment. They say we have no future, like the Palestinians. So it's a different form of solidarity, if you wish, that may lay the basis for the wider project that Michael was mentioning.
But it seems there's also a risk of violence with identification, even the imperative of translation to make different forms of violence and oppression and domination commensurable with each other. I'm thinking, for example, of Eve Tuck and Andrew Yang's well-known piece, Decolonization is Not a Metaphor, about the problems with treating colonialism and settler colonialism as metaphors for all different kinds of wrongs that can then serve as a basis for translating between the experiences of different dominated and oppressed groups. And so in framing or envisioning what and dissent from the global war regime might look like, does there also have to be a space for solidarities built across incommensurabilities that don't rely on a machinery of translation?
I totally agree. I was saying it may be risky, it may be tricky, but most people with whom I have had the occasion to talk quite aware of the radical difference between their own situation and the situation in Gaza. And nonetheless, there is more than simply solidarity from us. This seems to me.
That's an excellent, maybe that's the kind of thing that could be helpful for even for closing, which is that I do think that we're proposing with this a a radically different notion of solidarity, one that doesn't involve having empathy or sympathy for the suffering of others, but requires recognizing that their enemy is really our enemy too, by which we don't just mean the IDF. We mean something larger than that. And that shifts what solidarity means. That's what we're trying to aim with this global war regime, as identifying a governance structure, which, although variegated and having very different terms in different places, is nonetheless a global project for itself, and therefore requires us thinking at a much larger scale about what resistance and liberation has to look like.
Thank you. I think that's a really beautiful place to end.